Jason Mann, a basic question. You're a professor of religion.
Mm-hmm.
Religion on the curriculum, is that something that is an object of careful study, or is it kind of a promotion of ethical behavior?
Yeah. Yeah, good question. It's a question that our students have all the time, right? Especially when they come to their first religion course. We have a one required religion course at Augustana. And they don't know, am I going to get preached at? Am I going to get made to be something I'm not? What am I doing here? Our religion department is one of our many academic departments. And we try to do good scholarly work, critical investigation of religion. So we can assure the students, right, and others that they're using their minds and, analyzing texts and doing all that good work. At the same time, though, religion affects our students' lives in real ways, right, whether they're ambivalent about it or, interested in it. And so it's we're always dealing with personal issues as well and helping students reflect on their own spirituality, religion. So striking that balance is tough, but fun.
Yeah, I wondered about that. Do you deal with primarily ethical things, or do you get into denominational differences and go across the broad range of religious experience?
Yeah, most of what we do, I'd say, is broad. When we're teaching courses on Christianity, we may be attending to a Protestant versus a Catholic versus an orthodox understanding of something. But often, these students many of them come from no religious tradition, many non-denominational. They're interested in what they most need is not, the minute differences between different versions of Christianity, but just, what do these Christians believe? And then what do Buddhists and Muslims and Hindus believe? And that's enough to kind of get them in and start thinking about these things. So it's less and less so probably about different denominations and more so about religious versus non-religious and Muslim versus Christian and how those cooperate as well. Yeah.
I've mentioned this before, but years ago when I was on the graduation talk circuit.
Yeah, right.
I told 1 year, I said, this is something they make you go through. you got to recognize the good intention of your parents and teachers.
Yeah.
They've been trying to get stuff, you to accept stuff and understand, and this is one last desperate attempt. But right. The fact is that I didn't remember anything from my graduation speech.
Yeah.
So I'm going to give you something you might be able to remember. Now, you know about the three R's. I'm going to tell you about reason, religion, and restraint.
Mm-hmm.
And, a little bit about those. And that, I've often thought about reason and religion, faith and knowledge. And nowadays, I think people want to believe in something, even if, as I've often said, even if it's just the Grateful Dead, they want to believe in something.
Yeah.
But the problem is, once you get a firm belief, facts just bounce off it. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, it's tricky. Often, first day of class with introductory students, I'm writing St. Anselm's famous definition of theology on the board, faith-seeking understanding, right? Mm-hmm. And talking about how this is odd for all of us, right? Some of us are so used to critically analyzing things, but we don't know where we stand. We don't know if we have a religion or what. Others hold so tightly to what we believe, and we don't want to question it, right? We don't want to look at it critically. So there's challenges from both sides, I say, in this class, right? Some of you are good at and interested in the critical part, right, and the investigations. Others of you hold dearly to religious traditions. We're going to learn from each other and try to really think carefully about things that matter to us. The students appreciate it. At the end of the course, my favorite comment, none of them want to take the course at the beginning, right? I mean, the first day, they it's either apathy or even sometimes like visible, like disgruntlement, right, that they're in the room. But the favorite comment and one that I and my colleagues get a lot at the last day of class is, I thought I would hate this, and I actually think it's really valuable and really important. So that's a great comment, right, that we win them over to taking this seriously and thinking about religion.
I used to tell my wife, don't ask me to stop and think. You might not like the results.
That's right. That's kind of where they are. But then they like it, you know, and it's meaningful to them, and that's wonderful.
I remember in grade school I ran into some things that the nuns were saying that I thought, that doesn't square with what we just had in this, and that doesn't add up, and this doesn't add up. And that gave me a real crisis of conscience because I thought, I want to be part of this religious community, but I sure have my doubts. For my confirmation, I took the name of Thomas Didymus. I thought that was appropriate.
Yeah, right.
I decided after a while, I'm going to forget the business of belief. I'm going to accept, but I'm free to think.
Mm-hmm.
And that has served me reasonably well all my life.
Yeah.
Because it's... It's a tough situation. It really is.
Right, right.
And but there is no ism. This is one of those general statements that can't be true. But there's no ism that doesn't have its flaws.
Sure.
I don't care whether it's in faith or economics or anything, or social behavior. You can always find flaws. And dealing with those sometimes is difficult.
Sure. And I think our best traditions, right, our longstanding traditions, whether they're Christian, non-Christian religious traditions or other philosophies, are the ones that can incorporate those doubts, right, who honor them and, you know, think of the tradition as an ongoing conversation and with lots of change in it, lots of questioning, lots of skepticism. Those are the ones that live, right? It's the ones that say this is the way, the only way, that don't allow for those questions that I think they peter out or implode, right?
Okay, you can critique this. I also figured, as reading the Gospels and so on, and I thought, how would you summarize this? You know, well, love your God and then love your neighbors yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But I framed it as if Jesus approached people, he's saying, in effect, I don't care what you've done, how can I help you?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, that's not a bad way to go.
Yeah,
I don't care what you've done. How can I help you?
Yeah, I won't critique that. I like it. I think it's a nice early Christian hymn that's now recorded in Paul's letter to the Philippians, right? That Jesus was with God, but didn't want to just hang out there and do those godly things, but came for radical service, right? It was a really early Christian hymn that just tried to encapsulate what this was about. How can I help you, essentially, and be one of us, right? So,
but you know,
pretty radical.
Though that radical teaching, we don't follow. We have to accommodate. We adjust. We take this part. We shade it this way and that.
Sure, sure.
And that kind of nags at your conscience a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, and it's tough, right? How to be faithful, how to be authentic in a world where, I mean, I think in the United States, Christianity often becomes a kind of cipher or placeholder or synonym with just being kind of normal and mainstream, maybe nice, right? I mean, it just kind of means you're in the norm, right? To be Christian means little more than that to many people, right? So how do you faithfully, radically live this stuff out when the culture is telling you, no, to be Christian, you basically, you know, be pretty good and, you know, get along, don't steal stuff. But, you know, beyond that, there's not a whole lot to it, right? I mean, it's hard to preserve this radical tradition in a culture that says, yeah, Christianity, it's nice.
Yeah, I just tell people, when St. Francis of Assisi came around, property values fell.
Yeah, right, right. And there's a radical, right? Someone who's going to return to the roots of this tradition and try to live them out in radical ways, right?
And I know people who try to live that way today, and property values fall when they come around.
Yeah.
People get very excited and upset.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, maybe you that's in the cards, right?
We forget just how radical that teaching is and how it goes against so many common aspects of life.
Yeah.
You have a book out on Martin Luther, and Reformation Day is coming up in October, and he always struck me as a very earthy kind of guy.
Yeah.
I think one image that I recall the action of grace is like snow on a pile of manure. And I thought, well, that's an interesting figure.
Sounds like Luther. He was colorful, right?
Yes, he was. What was it like examining his life and teaching?
Yeah. Well, I should say the book that I just had published this fall deals a lot with Luther, but a lot of other figures as well. It deals with some Lutherans, especially Luther, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Dorothy Zola is a kind of radical political theologian in the Lutheran tradition in Germany. She's now passed a couple of years ago. But anyway, another book that's coming out this next summer is more explicitly on Luther and this tradition. That will be called, I hope, Radical Lutherans, Lutheran Radicals. So getting back to this word radical. Mm-hmm. But to answer your question, yeah, it's really fun to work with Luther, I think, because he's such a say it like it is kind of guy, right? I mean, he had zero tolerance for elitism, for the kind of hierarchy in the church, and whatever smacked of a elitist sensibility. And, you know, he used colorful words to shock people into what he thought were important truths. So whether it's snow on dung or, mm-hmm. you know, the Pope being an ass, he used words, maybe not carefully, but wisely, to shock people, awaken people into some essential truths. And it's fun to look at that and see just how instrumental it was for Western Europe and Christendom at that time and through today, you know?
When you say that, people automatically think of Trump. Oh, shocking
right.
people.
Yeah, right.
But Luther had more of an organized thought behind it.
Maybe more to back it up. Though, for what it's worth, I hadn't thought of that analogy before. They both spoke off the cuff, and it got him in trouble, right?
Yes, yeah. It did. It got him in a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
But it is interesting how one man can so shake up a system. Now, there were other people. There have been, for example, there's a book out recently about atheism being with us from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you were a polytheist or a monotheist, there were people who said, oh, yeah, I don't buy that.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole thing with Luther, though, is he is one person who suddenly lit a fuse and things did blow up.
Yeah.
How do you account for that?
Well, yeah, here it's tricky to distill the kind of mythology of Luther, right, as this lone hero, right? You can watch a Luther DVD, right, and he's there posting his 95 theses on the castle church door, and it seems like...
Did he actually do that?
No, probably not,
that's
right?
That's what I thought.
Yep, that's probably part of the legend, right, of portraying mm-hmm. him as this isolated, lonely hero willing to tackle... you know, the whole church and the whole politics of his day. Certainly we know there's lots of other people that did that. There were reformers all along Christian history, some right before Luther in the German context, right, were burned at the stake, just 50, 100 years before Luther. They were asking for the same kinds of reforms of the church. I think the difference that Luther had is that there was so much unease with Rome when Luther started making his theological protests against the church, that they were ready for him. And the peasants, the common people, mainly the issue was their taxes were being sent off to build a basilica that they would never see, right? They had local princes that they ought to obey, but then there's also the emperor and the pope, and it was just this really... you know, intricate, difficult political and economic situation that they were disempowered by. Here, Luther critiques the Pope and the Emperor on theological grounds, right? But the peasants just, you know, want them off their backs, essentially. And so Luther really gains a lot of popularity and protection from the local princes because it's a political affair. As well as a ecclesiastical affair, so they're ready for him, right? And you know, you could think about history through hypotheticals. Many would say, if not Luther, someone else. Like they were ready. Christendom, this Central European church body, was ready to get some cracks in it. It was already cracking, and Luther kind of put a spoke in there and wedged it open.
Well, you know, there was this tension. We're doing a play, Murder in the Cathedral,
yeah,
about
right.
Beckett.
Yeah.
And that tension is what animates that. Henry wanted to get control of the church because the church was soaking up land and money.
Yeah.
And he figured, no, this is, and they had separate courts.
Mm-hmm.
So this was not a good situation. But unfortunately, that precipitate action gave the Pope some leverage. He quickly made Beckett a saint. So there.
Yeah.
and Henry had to do penance. And it wasn't until Henry VIII that they were able to effect what Henry II wanted to do.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a similar kind of situation in northern Germany in the early 16th century. Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, it must have been for many people like the world splitting apart.
Yeah. Yeah. I do. I think of, you know, different cataclysms, big events, whether it's 9/11 or a new administration that people think, well, this is, you know, the end of the world or something radically new. And certainly all those things are really important. But I do think that 16th century Europe probably felt like this is just a whole new civilization, a whole new way of being in the world that we're embarking on, because it was just many, many hundreds of years where things were not static, but the politics and the economics were very stable, and there was very little change that happened mm-hmm. during that time. So here's a spark that lit a fuse that broke things up.
You know, you can talk about faith and reason and order and so on. But men have this thing about power. Mm. You know, who has the power? And that is a contest that goes on. There are positions of power, the president, a governor, a legislator, a mayor, a pastor, mm-hmm. a teacher, mm-hmm. a father. Those are power positions. Mm-hmm. And men do not yield power easily.
Yeah.
So you had a big power structure then that was starting to come apart.
Right.
And we've been trying to bring it down ever since.
Yeah, yeah.
At least get it within some kind of manageable arena. But it's not easy.
Yeah, yeah. And Luther, I mean, that's a good way to think about Luther, I think. I mean, he was a democratizer, whether he wanted to be or not. Now, he was no kind of egalitarian, you know, people's person. He, too, was very well educated. He was in the upper echelons of society, right? But the way he talked about Christianity, for example, that everyone is a priest, that there's a priesthood of all believers, right? I mean, priest, according to Luther, should mean a servant, right? Just like Jesus. And it says, well, we're all servants. We're all servants of one another. That's what Christians are called to do, right? The priest is no better than the rest of us, right? If anything, the priest should be the best servant, and the Pope should be a servant among servants, right? That tends to kind of break down these hierarchies and lead to this kind of democratization, not only of the church, but of society, right? So some say that the Reformation and the American and the French revolutions are intricately connected, part of the same new thing happening in Europe during this time.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, one of the ironies that struck me early on, you look at the teachings of Jesus and his behavior, and he was not for the patriarchal system at all, not even a little
right.
bit.
Right.
But then the church that is formed around him is highly patriarchal.
Right.
You think, don't you see this?
right. Yeah, in some ways, you know, Jesus is anti-church, anti-establishment,
he is.
And then we make a church in his name and you deal with all the ironies and complexities of that, right? Yeah.
Yeah, that is one thing that puzzled me. I thought, how could you not see this?
Yeah, right.
But I guess, you know, and women, I thought the people who seemed most attracted to his teachings were women and slaves because they were the ones at the bottom of the barrel.
Yeah.
And they stayed there. Once Christianity took effect, they stayed there.
Yeah.
They stayed in a subordinate position.
Yeah. Some studies have shown, yeah, certainly the lowest of the low, as you might call them, are attracted to this. And certainly those are the folks that Jesus is hanging out with, right? Tax collectors who are despised and prostitutes and women. And there's also some evidence that it's those that are kind of caught between the different layers of society, those who are in marginal positions, are the earliest Christians, that they find in Christianity, for whatever reason, a place to be where society otherwise doesn't have, right, a way of making sense of them or a place for them to be, which is just fascinating, right? That this religion would provide a place. The church would be a home for those that otherwise, you know, aren't a soldier or aren't a governor or aren't a landowner, but now are a Christian, right? And that becomes their identity. It is radical stuff. I like that word.
It truly is very radical. And another thing that struck me is the principal witness of the resurrection was Mary Magdalene.
Yeah, right.
Why isn't she at the top of the heap?
right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the church has been patriarchal from the get-go.
Yeah. But that was society at the time.
That's right. And some would say, right, there's no way that this religion, quote unquote, would have started at all had it not, you know, been also patriarchal, also used the system of powers that were in place. But this too breaks down and gets reconfigured in times like the Reformation. Certainly, you know, early Lutherans, as they come to be called, aren't ordaining women from the get-go, but they are making school available for boys and girls, something that's unprecedented during that time, right? And Luther wrote, right, very vividly about the need for this. They're starting welfare programs that are available for men and especially widows, women who were trying to raise families on their own. Luther said it's the duty of Christians to make resources available for these people. It's really the first social welfare program that's coming out of the Reformation. And then eventually, because they're thinking about priests or leaders of churches not as representing Christ and therefore needing to be a male, but as leaders of the community to be servants of them. Eventually, as we know, women are able to do that as mm-hmm. well. And some Lutheran churches, the ELCA Lutheran Church, for example, ordains women. And women provide much of the leadership of the church.
I've always thought that was the case, that the women are the strength of the church, any church.
Yeah.
You name it, there they are.
Yep.
Oh, well. We're being too radical, Jason. What's wrong with you?
That's right.
Well, we're going to talking to Professor Jason Mann, a professor of religion at Augustana College, and we'll do that some more. But right now, time for the composer's date book.